saving money on your next project now at Menards. Don't let an outdated garage door define your home. Revamp your home's appearance with a new Ideal Garage Door. Choose from our large in-stock selection or design your own using our free Garage Door Designer. Hurry in and save big money on your next project. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah, a registered associate nutritionist and your favourite crazy bean. Full of Beans is on a mission to reduce eating disorder stigma and increase eating disorder awareness. Together, we will establish inspiring conversations with a range of individuals, including those with personal experience and their loved ones, as well as clinicians, researchers, and charities who are all working to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Using my personal battle with atypical anorexia and body dysmorphia, as well as my master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition, we will together explore the experiences of like-minded individuals who are equally as passionate about sharing their stories to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Please note that this podcast discusses sensitive topics and should not be seen as a replacement for evidence-based therapy or treatment. Hello, Jerome. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you. I'm really excited to talk to you. I think the research that you're doing is absolutely, it's fascinating. So I feel really privileged to be able to speak with you today. So I wanted to start off by talking to you today about the work that you're doing at EDGY. So for those that are listening that maybe haven't heard of EDGY before, can you explain to us what EDGY is and what you guys are doing and the research that's involved?
So EDGY is the Eating Disorders Genetics Initiative in the UK. And it's a project where we're aiming to recruit people who've experienced an eating disorder at any point during their life or currently. What we aim to do is a study that looks at both genetic factors and environmental risk factors in terms of the science. And we want to find out how those things interact together to cause eating disorders. Also, though, in EDGY, what we're part of is a larger network of or larger biobank study overall. It's called the NIHR Bio Resource. Mm-hmm. And when someone joins EDGY, they will also join a recontactable bank of volunteers who are willing to be recontacted about further research. Because that's the other main goal of EDGY, that we want to make research into eating disorders essentially faster, cheaper and faster to carry out for researchers.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, the project that you guys are doing is so important. And I think, you know, there's so many factors that do influence people being predisposed maybe to an eating disorder. So I just wondered if, to start with, maybe you could kind of explain what we already know, if anything, about the genetic link to eating disorders, and then if you guys have built on any of that information already through your research at EDGY.
So eating disorders are actually quite unusual in psychiatry, as in they somehow seem to get less attention, and there are popular memes around them as being socially caused. But actually, eating disorders as a group of disorders have 50 to 60% heritability.
Wow.
Now, what does heritability mean? It means the proportion of risk for developing an eating disorder, in this case. And over half of it can be attributed to genetic factors, inherited factors. Now, that's remarkable in a way, because if we contrast it, let's say, with anxiety and depression have heritabilities of around 30 to 40%. But I think it's more easily accepted in the clinical world or in the general public that depression and anxiety have both genetic and environmental causes. But overall, you see, then what we have then in eating disorders is a set of disorders which, for me as a geneticist, are fascinating because they're more heritable. It's actually relatively easier to find the biological causes of those of eating disorders than it is, let's say, of depression and anxiety, for example. Also, eating disorders have very distinct symptoms, and our early research in anorexia nervosa particularly is showing that they're disorders, probably disorders with both a psychiatric and the metabolic side, that it's not just that they're the classical psychiatric disorders, they're actually genuinely on the kind of mental health and physical health interface.
Okay. And does that differ from, you know, you mentioned the anxiety and depression. Is that where eating disorders differ, in the fact that they've got that metabolic component as well, or does that exist with anxiety and depression too?
No, not as far as we can ascertain. There's certainly poor physical health in anxiety and depression. Mm. And that does mean that certain things are important, like inflammatory markers, for example. But actually, what we don't see in other psychiatric disorders is clear indications that metabolism and body composition are involved in the etiology of the disorders and the causes of the disorders. Also, in general, the picture across the rest of psychiatry is, if anything is a risk factor, it might be obesity, but it's not probably the metabolism behind obesity, is probably the social prejudice that people get who are obese, right?
Okay.
And that's possibly what drives associations of higher BMI with, let's say, treatment resistant depression or other things.
Mm-hmm. And when you speak about sort of the metabolic and kind of the body composition, is that kind of the genetic side of it, those qualities being passed down from within families, is that the thing that's kind of the genetic side of somebody developing an eating disorder, or is it other things?
No, it's both. I mean, both the psychiatric and the metabolic side of it will have their genetic component. It's just that there will be slightly different genes and pathways involved. But also, I should say, how do the causes unpack for eating disorders? So basically, I'm talking mainly about the genetic component, and of course, there is an environmental component. What we don't find huge evidence for, though, is a very large anemic contribution from family and specific family environment. We find more evidence for general environment.
Okay.
General social environment, and there's a third factor, which is just general development. I think that's a neglected factor, that as organisms, we start out from a sperm and an egg, and then we somehow become tens of billions of cells. Right, and cells migrate all around the body and form tissues and form organs. And that process itself is complex enough that things can go subtly wrong in that process. And so actually there's a chunk of every complex disorder, including eating disorders, which is probably down to sort of just random developmental processes that mean that someone has either slightly aberrant brain development or slightly aberrant metabolism, or a combination of both of those things. Mm-hmm. In the same way that genetics can drive those things as well.
And I think that, I mean, that sounds so interesting, the fact that it could possibly be something that happens in the womb that could cause the development of that eating disorder. So I suppose I've got loads of questions I want to ask you about what you've said, but the one that kind of comes to mind first is, sort of without sounding rude, kind of what is the aim of edgy, because, you know, if it's something that's happening in the womb, that almost sounds like something that we can't control. So is the aim of edgy to sort of work out those factors that could trigger an eating disorder to be able to then screen for them and prevent them? Or
so yeah, I guess the first aim is understanding. What we need as a point of principle before we can actually intervene or develop new treatments, we need to understand what causes something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're really trying to do in edgy. In the scientific side of edgy, first off, is to identify the genetic variations and the biochemical pathways that might be important, either in the brain or in metabolism for these disorders. And then also the specific environmental risk factors that might interact with those genetic factors or add to the risk from genetic factors. And I think how we use that information then is interesting. So, you know, it's remarkable that, let's say, only binge eating has an approved medication for its core symptoms of the eating disorders. Anorexia doesn't. I think there are some medications approved for depression in eating disorders, et cetera, but not for the core symptomatology. And, you know, a simple thing is, can we actually find biochemical pathways that could potentially be druggable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we design therapeutics then that could help people? Of course, that's a complex area within eating disorders, and, you know, it might be remarkably hard to persuade someone to take a medication that would, you know, that would correct their restrictive eating, for example.
Sure.
That sort of thing. But the other way that we could potentially use the information is to in screening at some point in time. So not now, but we use a methodology called polygenic risk scoring. And conceivably, when our sample size gets large enough, we should be able to design a genetic risk prediction algorithm that could contribute a bit to overall risk prediction.
Wow.
I think that, but however, that has to be kind of cautiously done, because the thing about risk prediction for any disorder is that if you start to use it in a general population, that risk prediction needs to be incredibly accurate.
Mm.
And so the first point in time that we might actually use risk prediction is, let's say, when someone is turning up to GP or their IAP service with eating disorder symptoms. And could we, in combination with, say, blood biochemistry testing for their metabolism, also assess their genetic predisposition and use a variety of things together in a risk prediction algorithm then? But of course, that brings us to the other issue around research in eating disorders, because, you know, there isn't enough done clinically in the NHS. So we know that some GPs are very good with eating disorders, but we know that a lot of them are not. And, you know, we need to get to a world where GPs are trained up in how to identify people with potential eating disorders in order so that they can actually do the risk profiling and testing.
Yeah. So it kind of sounds, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying like the first sort of, I guess, I don't know what the word would be, maybe result from this would be that if somebody comes to, you know, an IAP service or whatever, you can screen for the eating disorder based on maybe the genetic things that you've worked out, or the metabolic pathways, or the bloods, like you've said.
And their symptoms and their, their other things. Because let's say disordered eating is actually a very common...
Mm-hmm.
The disordered eating are actually very common, but eating disorders themselves are less common. Yeah. So maybe I think the thing is that would genetic profiling and biochemical profiling help identify those people who are more seriously ill? And I guess the other thing is, would genetic and biochemical profiling somehow allow people to escape the BMI trap as well, right? Because BMI is is being, even though it isn't supposed to be used to tighter services, the resources are so scant that it is getting used. And but if we had a more objective measure of, you know, someone's biochemistry has a problem, as opposed to they can't get down to a low BMI because they have a high bone mineral density. I think that's something that we could aim to kind of replace the use of BMI, for example.
Yeah, I think that would be brilliant, especially, I mean, and this, I guess, is a question for you to see if you've seen this in your research, but I feel like a lot of the time BMI is used, you know, obviously it's part of the diagnosis for anorexia nervosa, but for bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder and OSFED and ARFED, that they're not, you don't use BMI, that's not one of the diagnostic criteria. So I feel like the sort of genetic and the social and all the things that you've discussed already, they could be like groundbreaking for kind of determining patients with the other eating disorders that we've mentioned as well, that currently might be sort of dismissed because they don't show those eating disorder symptoms that doctors, I suppose, have come to recognize just because of the rhetoric that an eating disorder is somebody that's emaciated.
Yes, and I think that it speaks to a scenario where there's simply not enough resources dedicated to eating disorders, that only those people who are in imminent danger of death are seen, are go forward into treatment. And it was notable, let's say, during the pandemic that services got so overwhelmed that binge eating disorder referral pathways got closed down during the pandemic. And, you know, that's, you know, considering that it's 3 or 4 times more common than anorexia nervosa, then that's remarkable.
Yeah. And have you seen, I don't know whether the research has shown this, but have you seen differences in the genetics between different eating disorders?
So we've done... Yeah, so at the moment we've only really done very large scale studies in anorexia nervosa. Mm-hmm. We published a study a couple of years ago of almost 17,000 cases from around the world. And there we found roughly, if I was to partition it, evidence that anorexia had maybe 55 to 60% kind of psychiatric and maybe 40%-ish metabolic. Mm-hmm. Genetics. We don't have currently the sample sizes to do the same studies in bulimia and binge eating disorder, but we did use another methodology called polygenic risk scoring to look at a smaller sample within the study called the UK Biobank, and we found some indications that it's the reverse metabolic pattern in binge eating, although the binge eating disorder clinical assessment in UK Biobank is just people answering a single question. Okay. Have you ever been diagnosed with binge eating or psychological overeating? So it's not really very detailed. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing at the moment is to try and assemble data from cohorts around the world of binge eating, where we at least have confirmation of that people endorse having a lack of control of their eating, to see if we can conduct a binge eating GWAS that will allow us enough power to see what its metabolic factors are, and to actually try and separate it out from the genetics, let's say, not only of anorexia nervosa, but also, let's say, of the genetics of obesity itself, for example. Because, you know, I'm reasonably hopeful, because although I'm not a clinician, I am a geneticist, and when you have very distinct behaviors associated with a disorder, very distinct symptoms, then actually generically that makes it easier to find a genetic cause. Mm. So I'm quite hopeful about that study. We look, it looks like we'll have a sample size of about 22 or 23,000.
Wow.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
How that goes.
Yeah. And something's just kind of come to my mind, when you were talking about the metabolic kind of factors that may predispose somebody. Do you think that, because obviously a lot of people, when they experience an eating disorder, their metabolism does change. So have you kind of looked into the possibility that the metabolic effects may be caused by the, if we're talking about anorexia here, maybe the restrictive behaviors? So is it sort of a chicken and egg, like which one came first?
Yeah. So with genetics, we're slightly, because the genetics that we look at is germline genetics. So it's basically the genetics you get from your parents. Mm-hmm. And it's genetic variation that doesn't change from when you were born until you, until your illness. So, so to some extent, but not every extent, what we find is not being caused by the effects of having the illness. We did get worried at one stage that maybe lower BMI, the fact that lower BMI is a diagnostic criteria, might be driving our findings. But we've done a variety of analyses to show that anorexia risk does have an independent effect on BMI, as well as and that low BMI does have an independent effect on the propensity to have a lower BMI has an independent effect on anorexia nervosa. In addition, other colleagues in the field, Sadaf Farooqi in Cambridge, they've done a really nice study looking at constitutional thinness, mm-hmm. which is having a low BMI but no essentially mental health issues. And they see that it's pretty much independent of anorexia nervosa. These are people wandering around with BMIs of 18 who are perfectly healthy, you don't have any mental health problems. And it's independent of anorexia. So I think what we see is not so much BMI itself, but some indication that the genetics of fat composition, particularly female fat composition, are the most strongly associated thing. And the thing about fat cells, what do? Fat cells produce hormones, and they're very important in regulating all sorts of processes in the body. And I suppose one interesting factor is that the thing that's most, because hormones differ between men and women, actually, the genetics of what hormones do is they activate pieces. I mean, on a very gross level, what hormones do is they activate chunks of your DNA, mm-hmm. produce proteins. Okay. And because hormones differ between men and women, the genes that are driving body fat composition in men and in women tend to be slightly different. Mm-hmm. And we see good evidence that it's the genes that are more important in females that are more related to anorexia nervosa risk. But we'll see whether that maintains when we look at other disorders. I think then what we need to do next, though, is we need to delve down into trying to find the proteins and pathways, biochemical pathways that are involved. Mm. And try to develop a kind of better understanding of specific biology that we can then go and study in the lab.
Absolutely. And I think, like you mentioned earlier, that would then maybe mean that you could, you know, treat the disorder with medication or drugs. And I think sometimes people are against the idea of that because it's a mental illness and you want to kind of deal with the mental complications. But the way that I see it in depression and anxiety, at least, and I think it would correlate with eating disorders, is often the medication is something that allows you to be at a level where you can engage in therapy. And so, like you said earlier about kind of having a medication for anorexia, people might not want to engage in it because it stops those restrictive behaviors, but that would allow them to get to a healthy BMI. And, you know, it's been said so many times on this podcast that being at a healthy BMI is at the point when you can then engage in therapy, that you can't when you're at a low BMI. So I feel like the sort of mentality around medication would be quite similar.
Yeah, I mean, I think you would. I think it's important to bear in mind that the biopsychosocial model, right, sort of does mean that you should put kind of equal weight on each part of it, and then, I mean, also, you know, if you talk to any surgeon, as I occasionally do, they'll tell you that treating depression and anxiety in their patients is one of the biggest things they can do to help surgery recovery times.
Wow.
Right. And it's not just in mental health that we need to have a joined up approach. It's not that basically it's psychotherapy or drugs. And I think that clinical trial data also supports this in anxiety and depression, that it's the trials that actually do combo CBT and
absolutely
treatment that give you the consistently the largest effect sizes. And just a segue, there has been some interesting work in bipolar disorder to suggest also the same applies to bipolar disorder, so that people learn better and respond better to treatment when they're properly medicated, psychological treatment. Yeah,
absolutely. I think I agree. Like I said earlier, I think it just allows you to be in a place where you can kind of engage in that sort of therapy. And just once we're talking about the anxiety and depression, I know that you've been also involved in the GLAD study. And I wondered if you could kind of explain if there's been any correlation between the GLAD study and then what you've kind of noticed doing the EDGY project as well.
So the GLAD study is the Genetic Links to Anxiety and Depression study, and we started that nearly 3 years ago now. And we've recruited so far about nearly 28,000 people into that study. And I probably should have said this for the EDGY study. It's very similar to the EDGY study. We ask people to go to our website, do an online consent, a questionnaire, and then we send them out a saliva kit in the post. They can send back to our labs. But within EDGY, we've been struck by the number of people who endorse having an eating disorder diagnosis. So roughly speaking, around 5,000 people in EDGY have told us that they have an eating disorder. And we see, unlike in a lot of other studies, we see a lot of people endorsing having a binge eating disorder diagnosis. And we've confirmed that by putting the, as it were, the EDGY questionnaire as one of the optional questionnaires in the GLAD study. And we see that they indeed do have all of the symptoms required for a diagnosis.
Wow.
And traditionally, I think it has been hard for eating disorders research projects to recruit binge eating disorder. But actually in GLAD, we see that by focusing on anxiety and depression, we actually get a lot of people with binge eating disorder.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's hard to know, but anxiety and depression are core symptoms of lots of different psychiatric disorders. You know, so even if you look at schizophrenia, maybe 40-44% of schizophrenia cases would meet diagnostic criteria for major depression.
Wow.
And what may be happening, though, I think, is that anxiety and depression are quite treatable. There's an existing and popular clinical service in IAPT for anxiety and depression. And so a lot of people maybe identify their anxiety and depression because they're aware, also maybe more aware of it, and then they seek treatment for it, and then they think of themselves as having an anxiety disorder or having depression, but maybe they're not aware that they have an eating disorder, or maybe it's not the thing that they want to seek treatment for, and maybe that's why we see more of it in GLAD. But either way, I'm just really, it's kind of, GLAD is one of the studies where you can find it. Anyway, I'm glad that those people have joined GLAD, because otherwise, you know, I think across GLAD and EDGY, we're coming up on a 7,000 or 8,000 people with an eating disorder diagnosis, with both genetic and quite detailed clinical information, which is actually a very large sample, which is important because, you know, genetic discovery, we typically need large samples, but the other reason is that, let's say if a researcher wants to do a study where they compare effects of an intervention or other things across, let's say, bulimia and binge eating disorder, they can come to us and we have this recontactable bank of people who've actually said that they're willing to be recontacted about future research.
I think that's brilliant, the fact that you're building up this bank to allow people, because I think, like you said before, there just does need to be so much more research. And, you know, this is a fantastic starting point of working out, like you said, the biochemical pathways and stuff. But also, I think, you know, we know that eating disorders, there's so many different causes. And I can imagine that it must feel like a minefield sometimes of, you know, not everybody's going to have the same. I feel like it's a strange one because I feel like we know, maybe I'm wrong, but the cause of a lot of things we know, but I feel like with this, it's kind of the crossover of loads and loads of different things that could possibly be the cause of it. Somebody could have had a traumatic experience, which could have developed it. And I don't know, I guess my question to you is, do you think that it's always somebody sort of born with the predisposition, and you might not know this yet, I'm kind of just putting it out there, or do you think that it's they're born with it and then there's a trigger and then it happens, and without that trigger it wouldn't have happened?
It's hard to know. It's one of those scenarios where all models are wrong but some models are useful. So the idea then is, I think we use this thing we call basically the liability threshold model, but which genetic counseling colleagues, I mean Janine Austin, has actually translated as a jam jar model. Basically, the idea that you can fill up a jar until it overflows, and then you have a disorder. And actually, that's one of the things to think about here, that we all have some innate risk for a large set of disorders. You know, we might have, and we might know this from our own families, looking back at them, that we might know that we have probably a higher than average chance of developing diabetes, or a lower than average chance of having cancer or other things, just by looking at our family. And for eating disorders, yes, I mean, the usual environments, especially trauma and other things, are quite important in eating disorders. But maybe the genetics comes in then in terms of, yes, influencing whether or not someone develops a mental health disorder, but maybe also, maybe it's more importantly, maybe influencing which mental health disorder they might develop, because trauma is important across the whole sweep of psychiatric disorders. It might be slightly less important than bipolar disorder, but it's quite important in schizophrenia, quite important in depression, anxiety, and in eating disorders, and in ADHD. So I think maybe it's an individual predisposition, but maybe, I think, as I once said to someone, that people, I think this person had a traumatic event, and they, you know, basically, I suppose the question was why did they develop eating disorder and not depression or anxiety, for example. And that's where genetics, I think, has its most of its specific influence, as it were.
Okay.
Because that type of genetics I'm talking about is pretty much, it's a push in one direction, and then the environment can come in and have a further push, or it can amplify the genetic effect. That's another way to think about it. Or you could also think about it as the genetic effect and amplifying the environmental effect, right? But and then there's also this thing about development, you know. So it just may be the thing that something has gone wrong in child development in some organ or in the brain, and that causes an issue. And it doesn't have to be anything strikingly obvious, right? These are incredibly complex systems, and it could just be mild dysfunction. And that's the thing about eating disorders. Eating disorders have extreme behaviors, and they cause biochemical things to go wrong. And if your body isn't actually biochemically robust, if you find that a biochemical pathway breaking down when it's supposed to in normal people will have, let's say a simple issue is normally, let's say hunger would overwhelm any reward that people get from restricting. But let's say in anorexia nervosa, that doesn't appear to be the case. And that suggests a very basic biochemical issue getting in the way. Whereas that response is stronger in most people.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've never really thought about it in that way, that it could have that impact. But I suppose, I mean, it makes complete sense. And what I wanted to ask was how you sort of determine these things, because I can't think of the word, but I did biomed as my undergrad, so I should know the word. But you know, when you do a study and then it's sort of, so you were talking earlier about like the developmental thing in the womb or whatever, how, when we're in research, do we kind of know that that was maybe what caused it? How do you backtrack? Is it like bias, or like, it's the word when you ask people to like recall what they had for dinner? And...
Well, it's like, no, I mean, the developmental thing, I keep mentioning it, but it's almost impossible to actually address properly. Mm-hmm. But I think that the reason that I say that is that I don't think we should be far more cautious as researchers in trying to say that we're explaining 100% of something. Because I think from a principled biological developmental standpoint, it basically should be impossible to explain 100% of any complex human behavior or disorder. But instead, we should be relatively happy that we can explain a large chunk of it. But I suppose the other thing is, though, if development is causing issues biochemically, right, I would expect the things caused by the genetics to point to the same biochemical problems, mm-hmm. or the same organs and the same genes, the systems that are affected, rather than the genes. But so basically the genetics can give us an anchor, as in we can latch onto the biochemical causes. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully then that even in non-genetic cases, what we find will be useful.
Yeah. No, and I'm really glad you said that, because I think that is one thing we do need to be cautious of, is it is such a complex disorder, like you're saying. And I think often we try to just simplify it, like, you know, oh, there's environmental factors, social factors, psychological, physical, blah, blah, blah. And we try and bum, bum, bum. And, you know, if you've got those factors all lined up, then you're going to get an eating disorder. But it's not simple like that. And I think that's why I take my hat off to you, because I think you're doing an incredible job of something that is so big and so complex.
Right. Well, thank you. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's the uncertain. I mean, basically the thing is that if you have to be comfortable with uncertainty, I think, if you're working on these disorders, everything is kind of evolving. But one thing I think that gives me hope, though, is that in the last decade or so, we've made enormous strides in psychiatric genetics in general, and in the last 5 years in eating disorder genetics. Mm. So soon, I think we'll have, you know, the same quality of evidence and building up for specific genes and pathways in eating disorders that we currently have, let's say, for bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or depression, which have amassed larger sample sizes more quickly than in eating disorders. But I think if we have the evidence, though we can't, it makes it easier though then to apply for, I'd say, research grants. It makes it easier to seek out collaborations with people that might be useful, such as endocrinologists, for example, people who actually understand biochemistry much better than I do.
So do you think, this is a big question, do you think there will ever be a day, or do you think that, I don't know whether you want is the right way to put it, that eating disorders don't exist, or is that unrealistic?
I think it's unrealistic to expect us to be able to fully prevent mental health disorders in general. But I do think that we'll get to a place where we'll be able to spot people and diagnose people much more quickly. And I would hope that having a standard, you know, would have, I mean, it's a bit dystopian, utopian, right? So, but eventually we are heading towards a world where, you know, in 20, 30 years time, every baby will have prenatal genetic or postnatal genetic screening. They'll have their genome sequence lodged. When they get ill, their doctor will look at it and try and figure out whether or not they've got a higher disposition for that. They'll probably have better biochemistry and be able to test 8,000 or 9,000 proteins in a single blood sample then. Wow. And get, you know, a better readout. But I think the scope for improvement in eating disorders is massive though. So if we can enable faster and quicker diagnosis, then we'll get much better outcomes overnight. That has to be one of the aims. Unfortunately, we can't eliminate eating disorders, but what we can do is make sure that outcomes are better.
Yeah, and I think that's so right, because, you know, the research shows that the longer somebody's suffering, the harder it then is for them to have a life free from their eating disorder. So like you said, if we can diagnose it and we can prevent it from getting any worse at a quicker rate, I think that's a great place to be. I guess the other question I have for you, and this isn't really a researchy question, I guess it's more of like not personal, but I guess a lot of the characteristics that, and we haven't spoken about characteristics today, but the characteristics that do predispose somebody to an eating disorder, I've spoken to a lot of people on the podcast and, you know, they're not grateful for their eating disorder, but almost thankful that they've had it because it's helped them to kind of grow as a person or succeed. So it's not really a question for you, but I think, like you said before, getting rid of eating disorders completely, it's almost asking to get rid of the personality traits. So I think if we can prevent the personality traits getting out of order and developing into an eating disorder, fantastic, but still allowing somebody to have those characteristics, you know, the perfectionism or the, you know, being very committed, being very determined and things like that. And this is talking about anorexia specifically, but I don't think things like that should necessarily be seen as a negative or kind of abolished.
No, and indeed what they're doing is acting as additional risk factors. They themselves are partially, I mean, perfectionism and other things is partially genetic, partially environmental in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But it is notable though that in anorexia that we see no evidence, let's say, of a genetic relationship with IQ per se, but we see a relatively large genetic correlation with educational attainment. And then that's the sort of perfection, probably anyway, the perfectionism drive in people. So we should allow, I mean, basically that's the goal, isn't it? So that's the goal, to allow people to be themselves without actually getting hugely ill.
Yeah. And what a lovely way to sum it up, just be yourself without getting ill. I guess the only other question I had was, you know, we've kind of spoken there about the personality traits. Do you know anything about the sort of personality traits that predispose someone to eating disorders like bulimia and binge eating disorder? Because I think it's a lot less spoken about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that literature in depth, but I think that it's more complex. I mean, I know in binge eating disorder, right, there's overlap with addictive behaviors, addictions. Bulimia, I think it's a little bit of both things. But one of the things that we did though during the pandemic is that we ran a fairly intensive monitoring questionnaire in our GLAD and in our EDGY cohort, and we've actually got people to fill in a fairly detailed personality questionnaire. So I think we've now got sort of basically 200 questions measuring about 12 different scales on wow. people. And actually we'll be looking at this over the next 6 months in a fair amount of depth. What are the personality characteristics across different eating disorder diagnoses, and how do they compare to people with anxiety and depression, and how do they compare to controls? Because you know that I think that's an important issue. I think the other issue just to bear in mind though as well is that there's an awful lot of people out there who transition from one eating disorder to another.
Yeah.
And anorexia to bulimia is quite well understood, but actually there's a lot of people who transition from anorexia to binge eating, and even in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're also asking people about that in EDGY at the moment, to try and get an idea of what is driving people from one extreme to the other, and how do and you know, and then that's also maybe a failure of clinical services as well, that someone relapses, but they relapse with a slightly different eating disorder, then they don't get treatment. And then that eating disorder becomes established. We are trying to look at that, and we will hopefully be publishing on that in the next year or so.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that, because I wanted to ask you about that transition, because, you know, like you said, it does seem like one extreme to the other. They're quite, as you know, if we're talking about anorexia to binge eating disorder, they're kind of two ends of the spectrum of this restriction, but then, you know, this mm-hmm. overeating on the other side. And do you have any idea how they could be linked? Do you think there's a genetic element, or?
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to do a study a bit later, but there's possibly a common disordered eating factor,
mm-hmm.
right? But we don't know how large the genetic overlap between binge eating disorder and anorexia is. But we will know later on this year, I hope.
Brilliant. Well, I'll get you back on and you can explain what you find out. It's been so nice to chat with you. I feel like I've learned a lot. And it's quite nice as well, because I feel like I did my master's in eating disorders and I did my undergrad in biomed. So it's like the two merging together. So got a few flashbacks of my genetic modules. I just wanted to ask you at the end, if somebody's been listening and they want to get involved in the EDGY study, is there like kind of criteria that they need to fit in order to get involved, and where can they find out more?
So if they want to find out more, they go to edgyuk.org.
Mm-hmm.
So edgyuk.org. And there aren't, so we basically ask people if they've had an eating disorder at any point during their life or currently, or if they think they've had an eating disorder.
Okay.
Because we know that there are a lot of people out there who haven't been diagnosed or can't get diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing then is if someone is not suitable for if we think someone's not suitable for EDGY, then we often invite them to join GLAD as well.
Okay.
Basically the people should sign up and do the questionnaire. The questionnaire in EDGY is shorter than the GLAD questionnaire. Mm-hmm. The GLAD questionnaire takes about 45 minutes. The EDGY one takes about 20, 25 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And then if people meet criteria, then we send them out a saliva kit in the post. But what we say people meet criteria, it's not a diagnosis though. We say that according to their questionnaire answers, they could have an eating disorder. So we send them out a kit.
Absolutely. Brilliant. And I think that's something that we all need to kind of take on board a bit more, is that just because you've not been diagnosed with a specific eating disorder doesn't necessarily mean that you're not struggling and don't need help, which I think is something that we really do try and talk about on this podcast. So thank you for bringing that. And also, I just wanted to say, if you do want to get involved and you're slightly concerned maybe about doing the spit sample or something, I have done it myself and it's very, very easy. And it feels very nice to be part of such a big study that's making such a difference. So thank you very much, Jerome. It has been lovely to speak to you, and thank you for letting me take up your evening.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I hope we can talk again in the future.
Perfect.
Thank you.
It was fascinating to have that conversation with Jerome and to hear about the research that they're doing at Edgy. Please, if you've been listening and would like to get involved, head over to the Edgy website to see how you can. It's so cool to be part of research, but also so important that we're using our own experiences to help benefit others. Next week, we'll be joined by Keisha Thomas. Keisha is a nutritional therapist, but she also is from the Black community, and together we discuss how eating disorders present differently and how they're seen differently, maybe not even at all.
What we get so much here is this assumption that everybody is aiming for the thin ideal, whereas, yeah, like you said, in the Black community, in Black communities, it's not necessarily that thin is the thing that is quote-unquote ideal. What's often praised is the curves, the hips, the chest. What's also often praised is how straight a person's hair might naturally be, how shapely a person's nose may be, the color of their skin, the shade of their skin. So these are the things that come into sort of when we think about body image and within the Black community. But if you think about, that's Black people within Black spaces. Now, when you take a Black person out of a Black space and put them into a predominantly white space where they are now the minority, now we have this a cultural process that has to go on where a person is now trying to fit in with that group. So This is where the thin ideal might become internalized of like, well, is this what I'm supposed to be doing?
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe to be one of the first to hear it. Please also like, comment and share this podcast with anyone you feel that may need support at the moment. Not only those struggling with eating disorders, but also their loved ones, as this can be a very difficult time for everyone. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, and this podcast aims to motivate and inspire individuals along their path of recovery. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, charities like Beat, Seed and First Steps have great resources. Please also reach out to your local GP to see how you can gain support for your eating disorder. See you next time. Bye.